Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. In Craig's weekly column for the Florida Phoenix, floridaphoenix.com, he has an update for us this week, something we talked about previously on the podcast, Craig, and it's that collaborative effort taking place in Orlando to help save the Florida Reef.
Yes, I wrote about how people try to rescue the reef, including people who normally are not allies, SeaWorld and Disney World, are working really hard to grab the healthy specimens of the reef that are still out there, bring them into captivity and grow them and help them to spawn in the hopes that someday, don't know when, they'll be able to transplant them back into the reef. Because we, Florida has North America's only reef, and it's really important for fish habitat, crabs, et cetera. It helps to shield the coastline from hurricane storm surges. And of course, it's really important for tourism, you know, for people coming out to visit. But then I went on to talk about
diving, fishing, all of that kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. But then, you know, after applauding the people working together to save the corals, I thought, but who started this? Who's to blame for this forest fire that's raging through?
Yeah, and I thought that was a great line by one of the experts you talked to. You know, we think of coral reefs and, you know, the image of a tanker ramming into a coral reef and destroying it is obvious to conjure. We can think about that. But what you're talking about is essentially a virus for coral reef, not unlike COVID-19 for people, that is ravaging the coral reef. And this expert described it as a forest fire of sorts on the reef.
Right. So I wondered, was there an arsonist who set the fire? And the answer is not clear about where the virus came from. But what is clear, it seems, is that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers weakened the coral's ability to fight off disease, but with a dredging project at the Port of Miami, they wound up dumping sediment all over these coral. And studies have shown that whenever they're covered in sediment, it stresses them out and they're weakened and they can't fight off a virus. And they're already weakened anyway by being stressed by warming waters because of climate change. So
and those pollution and everything else that they're facing. Yeah. And it's not hard to imagine. You think this reef is along the southeast coast of Florida. Like you said, it's the only coral reef in North America. Another great natural resource, natural treasure that it's our obligation to protect for all of the world, in my opinion. So you have this enormous dredging project there in the Port of Miami, which lifts all of this sediment up and covers the coral reefs, which are living. And the sediment prevents them from, I'm guessing, getting the sunlight, the oxygen, and the, you know, spawning the way that they're supposed to. It's not a great leap for me to imagine that that could weaken the coral reef to the point where it's more susceptible to a virus, which is essentially the thesis that this your story is working off of, or one of the experts there is.
Yeah. Well, and the point I'm going to make is, you know, the Corps said, oh, everything's going to be fine.
Yep.
Nothing's going to be wrong.
Yep.
The Florida DEP gave a permit for it and said, we wouldn't do this if it wasn't in the best interest of Biscayne Bay, you know, and all of that now seems just very, very shallow, pardon the pun. And it turned out that the Army Corps of Engineers biologist who was supposed to oversee the whole thing was being paid under the table by one of the consultants who was monitoring the damage and reported that the Corps only killed six corals, which
I don't even know how you could measure six corals. I mean, it's just such an absurd figure.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of reporting and a paper trail that Craig details in his floridaphoenix.com story, which is really fascinating, which brings us to why you brought this out again, because boy, if a little damage is good, a lot of damage must be better, right, in Florida?
Yeah, because the Corps is planning to dredge again, because it turns out they forgot when they dredged it last time that they were dredging it to make it accommodate bigger ships. Mm-hmm. They forgot to count in there that the ships sometimes might need to turn around.
Oh,
so they said, oh, we need to go back and dredge all over again.
Yikes. The Florida Corps of Engineers, or not the Florida Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers They are also responsible for what's taken place in the Everglades with the dikes and the dams and the dredges, yep. Lake Okeechobee, the Kissimmee River, the environmental devastation which has gone on across Florida. The Corps of Engineers is a key player in it. And I forget which episode previously we spoke more in depth about the Corps of Engineers, probably one of the Everglades episodes.
And I think it was, yeah.
This idea of, you know, are they just following orders? And, you know, hey, you want us to build something, we'll build it. You want us to destroy something, we'll destroy it. You want us to do this, we'll do that. You know,
they save something, we'll save it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always with a very heavily engineered solution, because that's what they are. They're engineers. And as I point out in the column there, their slogan is Essayons, which is French for let us try, and not, gee, maybe this is a bad idea and we should rethink this before we proceed.
Wouldn't that be nice? It is always a case of shoot first and aim later in Florida when it comes to the environment. You can read that article and follow that story at FloridaPhoenix.com. This week, we've got a topic that we have mentioned in passing previously and a good deal last week, I believe, when we were talking about phosphate mining, and that is sinkholes. Philip Van Banen will be our guest. He is a PhD expert in sinkholes. How'd you find Philip, Craig?
Well, he did a Q&A with my former paper, the Tampa Bay Times, talking about sinkholes. And I said, this guy really knows the subject. Let's get him on the podcast and talk to him.
Let's do it.
Philip, what was it first got you interested in the subject of sinkholes? What do you have any personal experience with sinkholes?
Yes, I do. It actually started when I first came to Florida in 2003. It's pretty hard to ignore the fact, you know, I study karst or limestone environments. So everywhere you look in Florida, especially in the Tampa Bay region, you know, you're surrounded by sinkholes. When they were building the building that I am currently in at USF, there was actually some sinkholes they discovered when they were actually building that building.
Yikes.
So that's our region, right? And since then, I've been doing research in sinkholes from a few different aspects. We can maybe talk about that later, but looking at climate change and also looking at the pollutants that may wash into sinkholes.
Is there a particular area of Florida where you should be aware that sinkholes happen, or is it all over the state?
Actually, it's mostly on what we call the coastal plain, which runs from, actually goes all around the state, but it's widest in our region here in West Central Florida. What it is it's a very, very flat environment, which means that the limestone is very, very close to the surface, as is the groundwater. So there's not a lot of material sitting above the rock to protect the surface from collapsing into the voids that are being created by the dissolution of the limestone.
I have read that Florida gets more sinkholes than anywhere else in the country. Is that true?
I would say yes. I know that Kentucky has quite a few of them, but I think we pretty much take the cake when it comes to just a sheer number of them. Yeah.
Is that a cake we could send back to the bakery?
I am very perceptive, and I'm picking up that you aren't from Polk County initially. Where are you from, Philip, and how'd you get to Florida?
Okay, I'm a New Zealander.
Yeah.
I actually did my PhD in Canada, and then I got a job in Connecticut. And then my perfect position opened up here at USF, looking at karst environments. So there are very, very, very few of those jobs around the United States. In academia, you maybe a handful, or maybe like no more definitely than 10 of karst researchers in the like 3,000 universities you have in this country.
Wow. Well, you talk about that karst geology. Karst geology. Yeah. How pervasive or rare is that around the United States?
Well, all of Florida and the southern parts of Georgia and Alabama are all karst environments. Basically, what karst is, it's limestone that has been dissolved by water percolating through it. So the sinkholes are a surface example of that. You've got caves that are obviously below the surface, streams that sink down under the surface. Often in karst environments, you don't see too many rivers because rivers are actually flowing underground. Other places that you find it are in the Appalachia, Kentucky, for example, West Virginia, Virginia. Those are places where you have a lot of caves in Florida. And then you head out to Texas, San Antonio, that region there. There's a very, very large aquifer, which is within limestone. That's mm-hmm. called the Edwards Aquifer. And then you go up into the Guadalupe Mountains in New Mexico. That's another region where you have a fair amount of karst.
In your research, have you ever been into a sinkhole? Is this something that, you know, scientists go down into and sort of explore around, or, you know, spelunk, for lack of a better word?
Well, sometimes sinkholes are the only way you can get into a cave. However, in Florida, because our water level is so close to the surface, nearly all of our sinkholes are lakes. So if you look at the maps of Tampa Bay region, almost every lake you see is a sinkhole. But because we are so flat, you know, not many feet above sea level, mm-hmm. like we're talking maybe 20 feet above sea level in places, and even below that in other areas, you know, the water table is almost right up at the surface. So that's why all these sinkholes you see, all these lakes you see, they have that nice circular or oval shape to them. Those are actually sinkholes. If you go a little further up into Brooksville Ridge area and that, then the land surface is high enough above the groundwater that you actually can get down into some of these sinkholes without having to get wet. But yeah, a lot of the sinkholes, if you could dive down into them, you know, some of them you could actually get into caves. So a lot of these diveable caves are actually sinkholes that intersected massive voids under the ground, or caves under the ground.
If this geology is pervasive around Florida, what determines when a sinkhole actually forms? If what contributes to the actual, you know, surface ground collapsing?
Okay. Well, first thing
he wants the recipe for the cake.
Yes.
Maybe not the best analogy. I should have used that. The first thing you need to do, obviously, is the surface sediment and the rock has to go somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So if you've got solid rock beneath it, it's not going anywhere. So you need to have a cave or a void underneath the ground that is big enough for the roof above it and the sediment on top of that rock to then collapse into it. So if you have small little voids that are in the ground, let's say maybe, you know, 2-3 meters across, and you've got a fair amount, you know, they've got maybe 10 feet of rock above it and mm-hmm. another 5 feet or 10 feet of sediment on top of that, then you're not going to get a sinkhole forming. If you've got, you know, sinkhole, you've got rocks that are like much, much, you know, voids that are much bigger, you know, talking maybe 10 meters or even more, then, and you don't have a lot of rock above that, then there's a good chance that some of that, the rock will actually collapse into it. One of the most common times we have these sinkholes forming is when we have a drop in the water table. That can occur in the wintertime when we get less rainfall, or it can occur when farmers pump a lot of water out of the ground. And that also occurs often in wintertime. You may remember going back to 2000 when there was an extremely cold period. And the farmers wanted to protect their strawberry crops, so they pumped hundreds of millions of gallons, but certainly, mm-hmm. you know, at least 100 million gallons out of the ground in a very short period of time to protect their crops so that they didn't freeze. And because of that, they lowered the water table. And water, as you know, you can't compress it. So therefore, the water table keeps the surface of these voids intact. But as soon as you start dropping the water in those voids, there's nothing to hold up those ceilings, roofs of those caves, and therefore they collapse. Another way that you can cause sinkholes is if you put a lot of weight on top of that rock, and then that can lead to a collapse. Great example of that is when they're building the Salmon Expressway. You may remember that one of the big pylons that they put into the ground where it was going to hold up the elevated expressway collapsed into the ground. And the reason it collapsed into the ground is actually a big void that was sitting beneath that big pylon that they were actually building. Now, not all sinkholes are collapse features. Sometimes you've just got a void that exists, and there may be, you know, a crack, a fracture or a fissure in the rock that allows that fine sediment to percolate, get washed down into that void. And those are nowhere near as dramatic. They're not, they don't tend to be quite as large. Mm-hmm. They're more of like a dimple in the landscape, not a very, very, you know, dramatic, larger sinkhole that you people often think about that you see in the news.
Yeah.
You know, those are the ones that are actually quite common, especially up in areas like Kentucky. Whereas here in Florida, we have a combination of both the kind of the collapse types of sinkholes and the ones where we have, you know, the slow percolation of the sediment into this void, leading to that like golf ball dimples on the surface.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about the weight. It occurs to me, was that perhaps one of the contributing causes to the big sinkhole that opened up under a phosphogypsum stack at the Mosaic phosphate facility back in 2016?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question. I was interviewed on the news about that, and it's definitely could be a contributing factor because, you know, obviously there's a wet slurry, there's a lot of weight to that, and it gets built up and up and up and up and up. And then, yeah, so you may have enough weight. Now, of course, you have to have something underneath that. So there must have been a pretty good-sized void under the ground. Maybe over time, those voids obviously get larger and larger because, you know, limestone can be dissolved by water flowing through rock. So maybe it created a threshold that was breached by the weight that was above that void. So it may have just led to that straw on the camel's back leading to the snapping of that. Therefore, you had that big collapse of that stack.
And that was in the same area where they had another one like 10 or 12 years before that was so big, people joked that it was the new Disney ride, Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Yeah, it was there. I think the Mulberry one was, what, over 200 feet deep, yeah. I think, at least.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it was big.
Is there any way to test for sinkhole potential beforehand, say, you know, your Department of Transportation or you're one of these mining companies, or you're just a home owner and you want to build a home somewhere? Is there any way, is there like a ground testing or a, you know, any sort of way to determine if the property you're thinking about building on is prone to sinkholes?
Yes, there is. You call it geophysics, where there are a couple of different things they can do. One is they can use something called ground penetrating radar, and it just sends, you know, the radar waves into the ground. And if you come across a void in the ground, then you'll see a change in that signal. It's like a lawnmower, you know, that they just push across the ground. They just look for changes in the signals. And if there is a void that's kind of large enough, then they'll actually detect it. If the void goes down maybe 100 feet, they probably can't detect that. If the void's like at 30 feet, then they may actually be able to see a change in the signal. Another thing that you can do is do something called electrical resistivity tomography, or call it ERT for short. Mm-hmm. That actually, you put little electrodes in the ground and you send electrical signals through it. And the change in the current will tell you what's happening under the ground. And if you definitely see big changes in that signal between the electrodes, that'll then tell you if there is actually a void. Sometimes it may be, you may find there's just different layers of rock, different types of rock, maybe, you know, chert layers as opposed to limestone, or clay layers as opposed to limestone. That can kind of create a complicating factor. But if you do have a big void under the ground, and again, if it's like at 30 feet, maybe 50 feet, you can detect it, then yeah, you can find those. Another technique that people tend to use is something called boreholes, where you basically just drill a hole in the ground and you just see, like, you know, if you're drilling into the ground and all of a sudden your drill bit drops, is dropping because there's nothing there, right? And then it stops when it hits the rock. That's a way that you can actually find these voids, but it's not cheap. You imagine if you wanted to build a highway, which is, you know, it's like hundreds of miles. There's no way that you can bore every 50 feet. It's just going to be take too long. It's going to be too expensive. The one thing that kind of surprises me about that pylon collapsing in the ground when they're building the expressway is that I don't know why they didn't know the void was there in the first place. If you're going to build something, you would think you would do something like that to see if there's actually a big hole under the ground. So I'm flabbergasted why they didn't find that. So it's not like they had to go elsewhere. Now, there's one really complicated thing about karst environments. Think about Swiss cheese. And Swiss cheese, when you cut it in half, it's full of different holes, right?
Yep.
Some of the holes are big, some of them are small. Sometimes it's just solid cheese. So if you're thinking about it and you're coring your cheese, sometimes you'll find a hole and sometimes you won't. So that's the issue with, you know, doing things like drilling into the ground. You may drill right beside a void that's like 15 meters across, but you just happen to hit solid rock. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you don't know it's there.
Wow.
And that's the real complicated thing about the type of environment Florida is. There is massive caves in one location, and you only got to go 20 feet from that, and you'll find solid rock.
How often do people fall into sinkholes or get swallowed by sinkholes? I know there's one very famous incident.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, that was the one?
That's it. You don't. There have been a couple of instances that I've heard of. One was kind of humorous in that there was a lady driving into a parking lot, and she thought it was a big puddle, but a sinkhole had just formed, and she actually was driving to the sinkhole. And her car started to get deeper and deeper and deeper, and someone managed to pull her out of the car. There are very, very, very few deaths that occur with, you know, sinkholes. Sinkholes occur, some can occur very quickly, but you can usually tell that something is happening before the actual collapse event occurs.
Mm-hmm. There was another incident, another kind of funny one that I read about, where I think it was a woman in Pasco County, because Pasco County seems to be sinkhole central, where she went out in her backyard and a small sinkhole had formed out there, and she didn't realize it. She fell in. And so she was calling for help, and I guess a neighbor came and helped her out. And then about a year later, she went in her backyard for something else, and it fell into a different sinkhole. And this time she had a cell phone with her, and she was able to dial 911. It's like, lady, just stay out of the backyard from now on. Okay?
Yeah. Sinkholes can actually be, you know, we always think about these big sinkhole swallowing houses, but some of them can actually be really quite small, you know, like maybe 20 centimeters or 30 centimeters across.
Wow.
They don't have to be big. They can actually be quite small. Now, sometimes they may start expanding, getting bigger and bigger, but they don't always have to be, you know, big enough to swallow cars or houses or highways.
Right. Is the prevalence of sinkholes around Florida changing with more development, with more pumping of water for agriculture and development and just drinking and watering golf courses and bottling? Are there more sinkholes now than there used to be?
You know, I don't think anyone studied that.
Well, there you go.
It's
there you go. Free idea. Go after it.
You know what? When I say no one studied it, I don't know of really many publications at all. I think I know of maybe one, but they just looked at a very small region.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually something I had a student of mine, an intern, looked at newspapers throughout all of Florida for the last, since 1960, I think, trying to see if there has been changes in the sinkholes. But that's the media reporting them. You know, a lot of the time, sinkholes don't end up in the media. They just get, you know, reported by insurance companies. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's definitely something that I've been thinking about. So it's not a free idea.
Doggone it.
You brought up an interesting question or idea about the insurance. Is that something that's covered in a homeowner's policy or an auto policy? How does that work generally?
Yeah, actually, if you are buying a house in Florida, you have the option, depending on where you are, whether you buy sinkhole insurance. If you live in Pasco County, I would strongly recommend you buy sinkhole insurance. I live in Pasco County, up on top of the hill. You know, I'm not sure if you're very aware of St. Petersburg or Pasco County, but you know, there is land that's like 30, 40 feet above sea level. And there is a lot of sediment sitting above that limestone. So we don't really have many sinkholes in this area. If you're in very, very flat-lying areas, like, you know, the coastal area of Pasco County, then, yeah, there is a chance you could get sinkholes forming. A friend of mine lives in eastern Pasco County, and his neighbor had to pump lots of concrete into the ground because a sinkhole was starting to form by his house. It's definitely something that
and that's
is
a common,
necessary.
Yeah, that's the prescribed mitigation is to pour concrete into the ground. If you've got one forming and you don't want to, you know, demolish your house or see it eaten up, that's what you do, is you just pour concrete and let it dry and turn it into rock, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually called grout. You know, like grout, you grout your tiles. That's actually what it's called. It's a very slushy concrete that they just drill a hole into the ground and they just start pumping trucks and trucks of grout into the ground to just, turn it into solid rock.
I have read that the folks in the villages have so many sinkholes, they actually have concrete trucks on sort of like on speed dial.
Really?
Get them out there that quickly.
Maybe they're driving their golf carts around too much.
Yes. What's the biggest sinkhole we've had in Florida? Was it the one that swallowed the car dealership?
Which one are you talking about there? There is one up in, it's either Winter Haven or Winter Garden. I always get the two confused.
Yeah, I think it was, that's the one. Winter Haven.
Yeah. That actually swallowed the car dealership, a swimming pool, part of the highway or the major road that was going by it. And also, I'm not sure if it was a school, part of a school or something. But yeah, that's... In modern times, that would be the biggest one that I've heard of. Obviously, if you go back, you know, much further back in time, you know, you see some of the size of these lakes in Florida, and that gives you an idea of, you know, how you could get some pretty big ones.
Thinking about sinkholes, cars, you talked about Kentucky. Was that 2 years ago at the National Corvette Museum in Bowling Green?
Yes.
A sinkhole opened under the museum. And the employees came back the next morning and all these priceless Corvettes were heaped in a pile. It's funny. It was funny because no one got hurt, fortunately, and it took place overnight. But if you want to go online, there are remarkable photos of all of these limited edition, special, classic, antique Corvettes swallowed in a sinkhole there in Kentucky.
Yeah, I actually have an experience. I have a strange connection to that. My very first PhD student, Dr. Jason Polk, actually is a professor at Western Kentucky University.
Yeah.
And he was brought in as an expert to study that sinkhole. It was a lot of science went into that because they wanted to make sure that they plugged it up so that it didn't happen again when they put the cars back in that museum.
They were able to rescue the cars?
Not all. I mean, they pulled them all out of there, but I mean, some of them were legitimately junked. I mean, they were just heaps of, you know, they looked like they'd been in rollover accidents on the interstate. Because Corvettes are fiberglass. So, I mean, they're not going to withstand much impact. Obviously. Yeah. It's not like putting a Plymouth down there.
Now, what also intrigued you, talked about a lot of lakes that were formed by sinkholes, but sometimes sinkholes open under lakes and drain them. This just happened in Tallahassee not long ago, a place called Lake Jackson, where a sinkhole opened up and just drained the lake. And as a result, they found all kinds of stuff that had been underwater, including, I think, a couple of skeletons that wound up being traced to a Native American tribe that was not from Florida. And so now they're thinking,
did that just happen, Craig?
Yeah, not too long ago.
Because my brother went to Florida State and went fishing in Lake Jackson. Now, this is a long time ago, 30 years ago, but I had not heard that. Okay, wow.
Yeah. And so the big mystery was, how did that skeleton get in that lake if it wasn't a Florida-based tribe? And so one theory is that a collector had the thing illegally and tossed it in the lake to try to hide it, and then the lake drained out. Does that happen very often, Philip? The drain of the lake?
Not really. I have heard of it happen occasionally. Sometimes it's just that the sinkhole can be blocked with maybe sediment that was washed into it. Because, you know, sinkholes, you see they have a kind of a bowl shape, but often the only reason they have a bowl shape is because the sediment around the edges has got washed in. And sometimes that plug, like think about a bathtub, right? If you pull out that plug, the water drains. And sometimes the amount of pressure can actually lead to that plug in the bottom of the sinkhole washing out and then the lake drains. So I've heard of a couple of instances of that. And the landowners aren't happy because their lakefront property has disappeared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not good.
Last question for me, Philip. And you mentioned you were doing some research into possible connections between sinkholes and climate change. What are you working on there?
When I say about climate change, I'm thinking about, can we reconstruct the occurrence of hurricanes? And, of course, we want to know the hurricane instances that we see today. Are they just pretty much what we've seen over the last, 5,000 years, or is it something that's unusual? And my interest was, is when you have a hurricane go over the land, the coastal area, if you've got a sinkhole there, the sinkhole becomes a trap, and it traps that hurricane sediments. So, and when it's not, when a hurricane's not going over, other sediment accumulates in that sinkhole. So therefore, you can just look at, sediment cores from the sinkholes and see, is this a hurricane sediment or is it not? So when Hurricane Irma came ashore in the Florida Keys, we went to Big Pine Key where there's some sinkholes, and we extracted the uppermost layers of those sinkholes, and we could actually see the characteristic sediments of Hurricane Irma. So therefore, if you can go deeper down into these sinkholes and you pull out more sediment, you may be able to see evidence of these big category 4, category 5 hurricanes. So it's all about trying to figure out, how often do these big hurricanes come ashore?
Fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us today. This has been an amazing topic.
Philip Van Banen has been our guest, works over at USF, a doctorate and a professor over there studying sinkholes. Thank you so much for your time today, Philip.
Not a problem. Thank you.
It's interesting to me that there are, I know of a couple of sinkholes that have been turned into tourist attractions in Florida.
Okay, lay them on me.
Well, one is Sunken Gardens, right in St. Petersburg.
Sure.
It's right there in the name, mm-hmm. Sinking Garden.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps the more intriguing one is in Gainesville. It's a place called the Devil's Mill Hopper, where it's a sinkhole that actually is so deep it has different ecosystems at different levels.
Yes, yes.
Sinkhole. And then down at the bottom, they found bones. Mm-hmm. The early settlers found bones, and so they thought it was like a pepper grinder for Satan. So that's why they call it the Devil's Mill Hopper.
I think in one of our earlier episodes from the archive with Kathy Silustri, where we talked about roadside attractions, I think we went into detail on both of those. So that would be one to pull out of the archives, as is the Villages episode. And it's one of my favorite anecdotes you tell about how the Villages newspaper forbids the mention of sinkholes.
Yes. Yes. They don't exist.
Not in the Villages.
Not
welcome
the Villages.
To Florida.
Welcome to Florida.